directs the Center for Infection and Immunity at Columbia School of Public Health. He is the person who correctly diagnosed West Nile virus as the agent that was causing the death of birds and has been a leading microbe hunter worldwide. Rapid diagnostic tests, invention of new ways of finding infectious agents, and a really innovator, a great innovator, and a great addition to the World Public Health Center. Let me say that Lauren Murray Mangione is in the lab this summer, and he has had a number of previous members of this program in his lab, and I think the experience that all of you have had has been terrific, and I want to thank you for that, and for all the other things you do. When Paul DeCree wrote the book Microbe Hunters, which many of you may be familiar with, which describes the extraordinary progress of infectious disease and microbiology and immunology. He wrote the book in the 1930s. He didn't know that there would be an Ian Lissing, but had he would have said, what I've told you about Koch and Pasteur and Metchnikoff and all the early microbe hunters will continue in the guise of a man by the name of Ian Lipkin, and I think that's really true. What Lipkin is the modern incarnation of all of these microbe hunters. He has nothing to do with the Dalai Lama. He has not been reincarnated, but he is the successor to an extremely distinguished group of people, scientists, physicians, public health officials, who in every decade have advanced our knowledge and our understanding of the microbial world around us. So it's a great pleasure.
Thank you very much. That's very, very warm and deeply appreciated, Sam. This particular program is the future of the country and the future of science and public health, and that's why I'm really delighted to both host people who come through the laboratory as well as speak with you today. And at the very end, I'm going to tell you about a movie that we've just made, which is designed also to educate, and increasingly I'm becoming interested in education because there's only so far one can go as an individual. I was recruited here by the late Josh Lederberg and by the late Alan Rosenfield. So both of the people who brought me to Columbia from California are no longer with us. And what you see here really is their vision. So the first slide is Pandora. Remember, many of you remember from Greek mythology, she was told not to open this box. And she did, and all the diseases of mankind escaped. And she closed it up. And just as she was closing it up, she heard one little plaintive voice from within, that was hope, and she let that hope escape. And so we like to think of diagnostics and discovery as hope. I wear many hats. One is director here at Columbia University of the Center for Infection and Immunity, which is likely to become a university-wide institute in the next few years. Though we'll all still have an allegiance here to CUMC and to the School of Public Health, the World Health Organization, and a biodefense center that was set up by Tony Fauci at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Now, Sam mentioned Koch, and many of you will already know Koch's postulates, and they really haven't changed. We still like to use them whenever we can, and they're all well known to you, and here obviously is a picture of Koch, but there are many problems with Koch's postulates in the modern era because we have microbes that we cannot grow in the laboratory, and we may not have an animal model, and if you really hold all infectious diseases to the stringent criteria of Koch, you can't prove that HIV causes AIDS, but I don't think anybody here has any doubt about that. So obviously we use other criteria that convince us that this is a meaningful relationship. Thomas Rivers at Rockefeller in the 1930s talked about neutralizing antibodies, evidence of recent infection. Fredericks and Relman talked about molecular markers. This was shortly after PCR was really widely implemented. But the major problem really is that, you know, to prove causation, you've got to be there before the disease is manifest, because sometimes the infection may work in mysterious ways. It can have effects on stem cells. It can induce autoimmunity. There can all kinds of things that can become problematic, and I'll go through those with you. So in our mind, what we try to do whenever possible is go all the way through Koch's postulates, but sometimes we can't. So we look for genetic fingerprints or host responses that indicate a correlation with disease. Then we look for pathology. We try to demonstrate the co-localization of the agent in the tissue where the disease is manifest and show the histopathologic correlate of that disease. We look for humoral or cellular immunity, which indicates a specific response that's new as a result of exposure. And in some instances, we look at agent-specific treatment and vaccine prophylaxis. So there's an article in the New England Journal of Medicine, which is not a journal that many of you will read, with a commentary by Scott Hammer that just came out the day before yesterday, which looks, frankly, at HIV and at the risk of transmission of HIV between couples where one individual has HIV and the other doesn't, and they receive antiviral therapy that's sufficient to suppress viral replication below a single a set viral load within the blood. And there they very clearly demonstrate that if you do this, you can prevent transmission of disease. So this is an example of proof, but it certainly is not Koch's postulates, because we haven't deliberately grown the virus in the laboratory and put it into a human being to cause disease. So there are various ways in which you go about proving linkage to disease, and I'll lead through some of these as we move through the talk. This was an article that I wrote toward the end of last year, where you can find much of what I'll be talking about. If I didn't send you a copy of this, you can download from our website any of the papers that we produce, but this really gives you the majority of my thinking on the topic. Now, there's an enormous amount of uncharted territory. And this is a slide from Peter Dajak in the EcoHealth Alliance, also here in New York, with whom we do a great deal of work. And as you know, we've got 50,000 vertebrate species. If each of them has only 20 endemic viruses, there are at least a million vertebrate viruses yet to be discovered. So this is a huge population, and I can't pretend for a moment that we're going to get the support required to identify each of them, but it gives you some sense of the complexity of the microbial world. And here I'm not even talking about algae or bacteria or viruses or invertebrates. It's staggering. In fact, if you look at phage in the oceans, it's the largest single amount of biomass on the planet. So viruses are everywhere. Now, as a result of various new technologies and emphases on various challenges that we face, like the emergence of certain viruses, the Human Genome Project, whatever, the viral sequence database has been growing at an exponential rate. So if you do a search today and you do a search a month from now, you may get very, very different results. So one of the challenges we have in trying to discover new agents is that we have to repeatedly find new ways to probe all these sequence databases. Now, everyone here lives in New York, so this is an interesting statistic for you. There are 72 countries with direct routes just from JFK. So if you add Newark, it's bigger yet. 190,000 international flights per year, 21 million passengers, and you can see all the places you can reach on a nonstop flight from JFK. Now this, in a one-hour time span, the green flights are coming into New York and the red ones are leaving. And again, you could replicate this in Atlanta, at Hartsfield, or at Reagan, or wherever. I mean, there's a staggering amount of travel. And this means, of course, that people are continually bringing new agents in. We also have global trade in animal products, pork, beef, poultry, and so forth. You can see more and more of it is produced around the world and is distributed. Therefore, if something emerges somewhere in the world, it can readily be in New York or Frankfurt or Los Angeles or what have you. I'm just talking about the things that we know about. Now, when we start getting into issues of bushmeat trade, this is a staggering amount of money. So look at these values for Liberia, Ivory Coast, Gabon. 5 billion kilograms per year traded in the Congo Basin alone. And 80% of all the animal-based household protein consumed in Central Africa is, in fact, bushmeat. Now, a lot of this bushmeat is beginning to come in to Queens and Staten Island and places where we have certain populations that like to bring their foods with them. So this is Central Africa. We've already talked a little bit about this. This is what we see in South America. Here we have the scale, which is absolutely unmatched anywhere because the Chinese have so much money. And basically what they do, particularly in Cantonese cuisine, is they get increasingly more exotic animal meats that are thought to have various properties. So we estimate there are 90,000 kilograms of bushmeat that pass undetected through the U.S. every year. It's even more in Paris. And China, as I've already said, is probably staggering. Recently, we've been looking at samples that have just come in through JFK, and it's amazing what people will bring in. So here you see heads of primates. Here's another head, limbs and so forth. And we're finding, chiefly because these are dried meats, we're finding bacteria, we're finding DNA viruses. We haven't found any RNA viruses yet, but now there are fresh meats that are coming in as well. In 2003, I worked with the Chinese government to try to address the challenge of SARS, and this is a picture of me and Thomas Breeze with the head of the Academy of Military Medicine, Weifu Yang, and this is Chen Zhu, who's now the current Minister of Health. It's interesting that as this epidemic was just beginning, Hong Kong initiated this interesting advertising campaign to bring people into Hong Kong, which was obviously quite timely and was taken off quickly. But this was quite an exposure, quite an interesting situation, because I gave a talk to the PhD students, two of which were Chinese nationals, and by the time I'd finished my lecture, the Chinese consulate was in my office waiting to talk with me, and they said, we need you to go to Beijing because we don't have a way to diagnose SARS coronavirus infections, and we're also facing a revolution. It was very interesting that the Marxists viewed this as evidence that the opening to the West had brought in all sorts of things which were problematical, and so there was turnover in the party and such, and they fired the mayor in Beijing and did a number of other things. Of all the institutions in New York, and I went to all of them, Rockefeller, Cornell, Sinai, what have you, they were all told, the professors there who were part of our biodefense center, that if they went to Beijing during the middle of this outbreak, that they would lose their tenure and they would come back to no job. And the only group that was willing to let us go was Alan Rosenfield, who was the dean, and Lee Bollinger, who was the president. So despite the fact that there was an advisory, I'm very proud of that, Sam. I don't know if you know that, but Columbia was the only group that sent any delegation from any university in the United States or Europe or anywhere else during that outbreak. And that was basically because I was disposable, so that was it. But now, the most single important person in the process of pathogen discovery is the clinician, because I sit in a laboratory and people send us samples, otherwise we wouldn't know about them. This is from West Nile virus, and the two people who were the most critical in this were Deborah Asness, who is an infectious disease physician in Flushing, and Tracy McNamara, who was a veterinarian then at the Bronx Zoo. And Tracy was talking about the fact that there were all these native corvids, crows that were dying, and Deborah had noticed that there were some otherwise healthy individuals in their 60s and 70s, spent a lot of time out of doors, who were presenting with encephalitis, but they had a paralysis component, which was unusual for encephalitis. And Deborah then contacted the people at the CDC, and Tracy McNamara contacted people at the CDC, and there was no connection between the animal people and the medical people on the human side. In fact, the people in Fort Collins at the CDC said, we're too busy worrying about this St. Louis encephalitis virus outbreak to be bothered with your crows. And of course, they recognized the error at the end when all this came together. But again, I just want to make the point that really this is, the clinicians are the ones who recognize these anomalies. I'll be talking with you about molecular methods, but one of the things I always want to emphasize is the traditional methods. The classical virology, microbiology are critical. If you can grow a virus in culture, then it doesn't make any difference what method you use. So with SARS, when Malik Perry started growing this virus in Vero cells, which are immunologically compromised cells, he is able to get very, very high levels of virus in the supernatant. And the first sequences of SARS coronavirus were obtained using sequences for a paramyxovirus, not for coronavirus at all, because two groups had independently reported electron micrographs saying that it was a paramyxovirus. One was Wolfgang Preisser, who was in Germany, and the other was John Tam in Hong Kong. And both of them said, we've got this virus, and it's a paramyxovirus. And Christian Drosten, who was then in Bernard Notch Institute in Hamburg, went ahead, used the paramyxovirus primers, sequenced what he found, and indeed, it was not a paramyxovirus. It was, in fact, SARS coronavirus. He was able to get sequences also with yellow fever primers and with actin primers and everything else. So growing a virus is clearly the best way to go if you can get that to proceed. And this is one of the things that I try to emphasize here. This is, again, from this review. You get the sample in, you try to culture it, you try to do multiplex PCR, animal models. Ultimately, you have to prove the link to disease. And if those fail, the earlier methods, then you go to sequencing. This is a simplified version of the same thing. I'll be talking with you about this method called MassTech PCR, which was developed here by Jingyu Zhu, who was in the chemical engineering department and in genetics, and me. When Michael Crow was still provost here and head of the Earth Institute, when I showed up, you may not know this, Sam, but there was literally no setup fund for me when I arrived here. I was promised all kinds of things, and then there was nothing. And Michael Crow called me into his office, and he said, I'll give you $500,000 with one caveat. You have to find somebody in the Department of Chemical Engineering who will collaborate with you in a project. And he said, don't tell me what it is, because I don't understand this stuff anyway. But here's a list of them. And I started cold calling them all. And when I got to Jingyu Zhu, he said, how much money is it? I said, $500,000. He said, I'm sure we can do something. I was sort of necessity is the mother of invention. So what we did is we found a way to take primers and to couple them through UV cleavable linkers to tags of various masses so we could do multiplex PCR, read it out with an inexpensive tool that Columbia has now patented and so forth. And then there's an array platform, which is cheaper and more robust all the time, and then high-throughput sequencing. Now, what this gives you is a series of candidates. It does not prove that you've found the link to disease. There you need to do all the things we talked about. Demonstrate seroconversion, pathology, the link in tissue to the presence of the agent, if possible, challenge experiments, and so forth. But that can be very complicated. So for example, let's say somebody has Clostridium tetanus growing in their skin. You may not find the wound at all unless you know to look for it, because they present with tetanus, or it can be growing inside their gastrointestinal tract. So anything that produces a toxin can have an effect that's distal to the site of infection, so it can be complicated. So I've already talked about this method called MassTech PCR. I just want to show you some results with it. The first work we did with New York State, we found that in 1 year, when there was a lot of influenza-like illness, where people were unable to find influenza at the Wadsworth lab, which is the best state lab in the US, they sent us this material. We resolved most of the unknowns, and we found this new virus, which is very interesting because it has now been found all over the world. It's a major exacerbant in asthma. It causes otitis media in kids. It's going to be leading to a vaccine shortly. And had we not used these methods, we wouldn't have found it, because it was literally there and no one recognized it. During the H1N1 pandemic of a couple of years ago, we began working with the New York City Department of Health to look at the incidence of that particular influenza virus. So the blue is that flu, and you can see there was a lot of it in May to June, and then it dropped, came up a little bit again in the winter months. But as it dropped, enteroviruses and rhinoviruses came up very, very strongly. And the assumption that was made when people say, you know, it's all flu, well, not necessarily. And there are drugs to treat this, and there are drugs to treat that. So, and they don't have any cross-reactivity. So you have to be accurate. It's not just in New York. Work we did with the White Mountain Apache and the Navajo in the vicinity of Phoenix, same time frame, again, a one-year track. And here you can see rhinovirus A and B and C and so forth. So, you know, there's a lot of clinically actionable information that you can get. During that same pandemic, we were asked by the government of Argentina to try to explain why their case fatality rate was so high. Now, every year, from seasonal flu in the United States, some 40,000 people die. And the case fatality rate is typically between 0.6% and 1%. And this is what it was with the pandemic flu in 2009 to 2010. But in Argentina, it was quite different. The case fatality rate was 4.5% versus 0.6%, so almost tenfold higher. And the question was why? Had the virus evolved in some way? Was it becoming resistant to drugs? Were the people who were affected different in some way? So we sequenced a whole series of different viruses from people with severe and mild disease, and we used mass tag PCR. And what we found was that there was no answer in the evolution of the virus, but for whatever reason, in this particular population, if you were co-infected with Streptococcus pneumoniae, which many of us carry, your case fatality rate was your odds risk ratio was elevated 125-fold over somebody who didn't have strep pneumonia. So presumably what was happening was the neuraminidase associated with flu was opening up cells, facilitating entry of Streptococcus pneumonia, which then led to a more severe disease, which resulted in hospitalization in an intensive care unit or death. This is not a new story. This goes all the way back to 1918. There was, in fact, in 1918, many people thought that bacteria were the cause, and that this is why Haemophilus influenza was named Haemophilus influenza. But in fact, and there is some evidence now from strep pneumonia trials, vaccine trials have been done in Africa by Shabir Mahdi and others, that if you've been vaccinated with Pneumovax, the chance of having severe flu are markedly reduced. So in fact, this reinforces that point. And probably the best flu vaccine right now I can recommend to people is a strep pneumonia vaccine, because this one clearly works. Now I'm going to talk with you a little bit about sequencing. Many people have contributed to this work. The method really doesn't matter. There are many platforms now. What you get at the end of this process is a series of nucleotides, right? You've all seen sequences at this point. And the question is, how do you make sense of them? So the first thing you try to do is employ software that links them all together so that you can get the longest strings that you possibly can. And then you look at the nucleotide level and you look at the predicted amino acid level in all three open reading frames, and you flip it around, you repeat the process, and try to find something that looks like something else in a database. And as the databases get populated with more and more sequences, and I showed you that exponential growth of the biosequence database, this process is facilitated. Nonetheless, something like 20 to 30% of the time, we don't find anything by using that sort of an approach. And we have developed a number of linguistic strategies, which I'm not going to talk about because they're too complicated for this purpose. But in any event, what you get at the end of this process is the entire tree of life, the viruses, bacteria, parasites, metazoa, fungi, and so forth. And you can try to figure out what's present within a sample, and then you proceed from there. So I'll give you a couple of examples of how we've used this. This is the first case where high-throughput sequencing was used to find an agent and resolve an outbreak. In this case, it was three women who had received organ transplants from a single donor who had been traveling in what formerly was Yugoslavia. He died of a stroke. His kidneys were donated, and a portion of his liver was donated. The women who received these became very ill within a week of transplantation. They died within a month. They were studied at the CDC in Atlanta and in Australia and sent here. And we looked at them with mass tag, PCR, and arrays, didn't get anywhere. When we did the high-throughput sequencing, we found 14 out of 100,000 sequences represented an arena virus. Now, if we had used any sort of other method that people typically do, like selecting 100 plasmid clones at random, we clearly wouldn't have had enough sequences to recognize this. So it was the technology that enabled this, but in addition, it was the software and the perseverance of an assistant professor in the group who pulled this together. Now, this doesn't prove necessarily that it causes disease, so then we need to go back and figure out what we can learn. We're not going to put this virus into another human being, so what we can do is we can look in the liver of the affected individuals And here you can see antibody labeling of antigen in liver and in kidney. And we created an immunofluorescence assay by transfecting expression constructs for proteins and coming back with sera. And we demonstrated that the donor was IgM positive, meaning it was an acute infection, and at least one of the recipients sera converted over a period of 2 weeks. So there was a temporal relationship. There was a relationship in space. So because of the time and space relationships, we said it's almost certainly the cause of this disease. That's really as far as we could go. Here's another example that we did in real time where we made the diagnosis in time to save one of the individuals. So has anybody here ever seen ProMed other than Lauren? Okay, so this is Facebook for infectious diseases. So you can get on here and you can read 3 or 4 times a day. There will be some report about something interesting happening somewhere in the world. It may be intoxication, it may be infection, it may be a notice of a meeting, what have you, but a lot of interesting stuff. And this is the way it typically appears. Undiagnosed fatalities, it might be people, it might be fish, it might be goats, you know, you never know. Tested negative, so we were sent these materials to test. And the story of the outbreak is as follows. It was a woman who lived in Zambia who was a travel agent. She became acutely ill. When she became comatose, they were incapable of caring for her in Zambia, so she was airlifted to Johannesburg for care there where they had a biocontainment unit. En route, the paramedic who took care of her and the nurse who received her on the other line became infected. The person who cleaned the room in which all these people were kept became infected, and they all died. All 4 of them died with acute hemorrhagic fever, which means they start bleeding from every orifice, they have high fevers, they go into shock, their organs shut down. The nurse who took care of these people was more fortunate because we made a diagnosis of what she had. She received a drug that was useful for the virus and she alone recovered. This is, in fact, in the history of hemorrhagic fevers, although it was an N of 5, this is the most lethal outbreak that's ever been reported, much more lethal than smallpox or Ebola or Marburg or anything else. It's just that it was contained. Part of the problem, if you're successful in this business, is that you don't get a lot of hoopla. But, you know, that's not what it's about. So this is an example of how we do these reports, how you look at the information. What happens is we sequence material that came directly out of this individual, and then we display it in an Excel spreadsheet so that you can look at fungi and bacteria and viruses. And when we got to viruses, we found that there were a lot of these viruses known as arenaviruses, and this became a coherent story. At the same time we began this work, the CDC in Atlanta recovered these 3 fragments. We got the black fragments, and they had a whole army of people working on this, whereas we did this in a matter of 72 hours. What they did took over a week. And that allowed us to recognize that, in fact, this was a novel virus. These are the New World arenaviruses that are found chiefly in Argentina and in Bolivia, the Old World ones, like Lassa fever virus, and this one, which seems to be a missing link between the two. And here you can see it moving from Zambia to South Africa. So the individual who recovered was treated with ribavirin and did well. This is a child who was sent to us with an immunodeficiency. It's a tyrosine. It's a Bruton tyrosine kinase deficiency. It doesn't matter. The point is the child doesn't make immunoglobulins. And despite the fact that he was receiving supplementary immunoglobulins, he became ill, developed an encephalopathy. He was worked up at CDC and at the University of Washington without success. And Lon Kwan, an assistant professor in the group, found 2 fragments out of 40,000 in a deep sequencing expedition that allowed us to recognize this novel virus that was most closely related to viruses that had been previously reported in mink. This child lived a couple of miles away from a mink farm near Puget Sound. So presumably, this was the source of the infection. Now here again, we're not going to put this virus into somebody who's immunodeficient to prove that this is the response. But what we were able to do was to make an antibody to recombinant protein, demonstrate that it was growing in astrocytes of the brain, it's not a contamination, and that it was present at very, very high levels. And it was not in neurons, it was in astrocytes. But astrocytes are extremely important in the brain. They're in terms of contributing to neuronal function. They regulate neurotransmission and vitamins and other nutrients and so forth. So it was an indirect effect, but potent nonetheless. Sometimes we're called in to do work in agriculture. This was an invitation from the government of Norway to investigate what was killing salmon. There's an enormous amount of salmon farming, as you know, and aquaculture, particularly in the ocean, is becoming more and more common. You can see these runted fish. You can see dead fish. This started in one farm in Norway. It's now spread throughout the world, starting initially in the UK and then moving down into Chile. And what we found, in fact, was there was a novel reovirus, and we're now making a vaccine, and we've taken care of that problem. This was something that was reported literally in November 2011, just before Thanksgiving. It was a virus that was killing turkey poults. And here, I want to show you, by means of illustration, another technique that we use to show the distribution of viruses inside of animal sections. So there's 100% of the animals that get infected become ill, 20% of them die. It's a new virus. This is a normal section through turkey liver. Here's antibodies labeling these cells within the liver of the affected animal. And here now is a technique called in situ hybridization, where what we do is we label nucleic acid, we place it on top of the sections, and in one four-panel slide, we can demonstrate dysfunction of the organ as well as the specificity for the infection. So here's the infected animal. Here's the animal that's not infected. You can see the viral probe is lighting up only the infected liver, but not the control. And this is a probe to actin, which is a normal housekeeping gene. Lots of hybridization, the control reduced in the animal with disease. So in this one four-panel slide, you can see specificity of the virus and the damage to normal physiology. Now, sometimes when we're asked to investigate infectious disease outbreaks, they're not actually outbreaks of infectious disease. So this was a syndrome that was reported in Austin, Minnesota, where people who worked on an assembly line slaughtering pigs were developing an acute peripheral neuropathy so bad that they couldn't stand upright. They were unable to function on the assembly line. And the CDC asked me to investigate this because they thought it was an infectious disease. But the more I heard about this, the more it sounded like an autoimmune disease that had been described by somebody named Byron Waxman at Yale, who talked about something called experimental allergic neuritis, which is if you take components of the peripheral nervous system, you can do the same thing with the central nervous system, and put it into an individual with something called an adjuvant, which boosts the immune response, some individuals will develop autoimmunity. They'll develop a disease that may look like MS, they may be called EAE, they may develop experimental allergic neuritis and so forth. So the epidemiologists who went into the plant mapped the distribution of all the workers and the disease and where certain functions were performed. And this work won the Charles C. Shepard Award, not 2001, this should be 2011. It was actually just announced about a month ago. So the pigs come in here, and they move around, and here they take off the legs and the other bits. And here's where they remove the brains. And here's where they pack the brains. And the dark rectangles represent people who don't have disease but are doing work nonetheless. And the yellow ones where there are people who are working in, who develop disease. So all the disease you can see is in proximity to something having to do with the brains, right? I mean, that's pretty clear. If this is an infectious disease, it might start here and then spread there and then spread there and so forth. But it looks like some sort of a dose effect. And that's indeed what it was. So I don't know if you can appreciate this slide very well, but this is the snout of a pig. That's the eye of the pig. This is the hole in the base of the skull of the pig. And there's a little hose that's coming up here, the same sort of one you'd use to inflate an automobile tire. So it's very, very high pressure. And then there's a plastic board with a little groove. And what happens is the air hose is used to homogenize all the brain material, which then runs in a slurry down here like so and gets collected and is shipped to Korea or to China. There's not a lot of local consumption of this, brain material, and it's not cooked or anything. I mean, it's just brain material. And this is the sort of this is why one of the reasons why I don't eat meat anymore at all. It's true. No, the more I started doing of this stuff, the less I eat. I don't eat anything anymore but fish and vegetables. So you'd be surprised at what you put into yourselves. Anyway, so this is the hole here, and this had only been implemented about 6 months before, and all these people started getting sick. And as we began to look at them, what we found was that, and they had no real PPE, personal protective equipment. You can see here bare skin, no respirator, and we found antibodies directed against central nervous system and peripheral nervous system. Now, the other thing I want to talk with you about is some autoimmune mechanisms. This has been my segue to that. For common agents, not everybody's exposed to the age. Same agent will have the same effect. In the 1600s, John Sydenham, who was an English physician, recognized that there were some people who had murmurs indicating, you know, some problem with valves in their heart in association with weird movements. And these movements were called chorea, which means to dance in Greece. And they're sort of like this. They're sort of weird movements like this, and people just can't control them. It's sort of like Huntington's chorea, but it's not quite as exaggerated. And about 20 years ago, Sui Susuito, who was a pediatrician working at the National Institutes of Mental Health, was seeing children who were coming into a schizophrenia clinic, and they had something that looked like Sydenham's chorea. So she took this in front of her, you know, this very simple IRB in those days, human subjects group, said, sure, you want to treat them with plasma exchange, you want to do plasmapheresis, you want to do sham plasmapheresis, no problem. That's what she did. And she found that these kids responded to plasma exchange. So if you moved the antibodies, you know, and just replaced them with albumin, they did well. If you gave them IVIG, they did well. And if you put them on antibiotics, they didn't have recurrence. So she reasoned it was very similar to what had been described in strep, Sydenham's chorea. And she asked me to try to identify the antigens that were important. And I tried as hard as I could. I did Western blots and immunoprecipitations with and without denaturation and phage libraries, and I couldn't get anywhere. So ultimately what I decided to do was to make an animal model and work backwards. So I took a strain of mice that are prone to autoimmunity. I immunized them with group A beta-linic strep with a complete forens adjuvant, and they indeed developed this response, and Mady Hornig led much of this work. And you can see here, these animals have these repetitive behaviors. They tend not to explore their cages. The blue one is the normal animal. So these animals tend not to avoid other animals and so forth. They're bizarre. And if you take the antibodies and purify them from these animals and put them into another animal, the antibodies go to the brain and the animal has the same behavior. Then we went into the brains of these animals. We pulled out the proteins that were complex with the antibodies. We microsequenced them here. We identified the antigen. And we created an immunofluorescence assay and found that 50% of the kids reacted with the same antibody, with the same antigen, as did the mice. So we sort of brought it full circle. And that's very useful sometimes, going back and forth between human disease, animal models, and vice versa. Now, in the late 1990s, Andrew Wakefield, many of you may know about this, came up with a hypothesis that MMR vaccine, which is typically given when children are 2 to 3 years of age, was associated with an increased risk for autism. And he published a very influential paper in Lancet that nobody really addressed head on until over a decade later, when we finally got support to do this. And what we did was to pursue blinded analysis, not only in our own lab and at the CDC, of samples taken from the bowels of kids with GI complaints and so forth, but to replicate the work in the lab that had given him his original results so that nobody could claim that we were missing it simply because we were weak in our experimental approach. And we didn't find anything at all, and we published that. It was very difficult to get this paper published because everybody either said, you know, we knew this already, what have you, but it turned out to be a very influential paper. And then once we realized that we had all these samples that had been collected from children with autism and GI complaints, and they were just going to go to waste, we asked what else we might do with them. Because it turns out that 25% of kids with autism have severe GI disease, so much so that it interferes with their education, their training, what have you. And some people think it may actually have something to do with the neurological lesion, though I don't know. We decided to focus just on the GI tract. So we took the samples from which we had RNA, and we did transcript profiling, which is a method that allows you to look at gene expression and look at what's up and what's down in different populations. And in the children with autism, we found some striking differences from the children who just had severe GI complaints. Now, when I'm talking about severe GI complaints, I'm not talking about a little bit of, you know, a little bit of irregularity that, you know, you treat with Activia, you know. I'm talking about kids who require biopsies to figure out what's going on. So this is a very simplified way of looking at the intestine. This is the lumen of the intestine. You have these enzymes that break down sugars, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and you have these molecules called transporters that carry the sugars across the enterocyte, and then on the backside, they carry it from there into the blood. And there's a transcriptional regulator, CDX2, that controls the expression levels of each of these. So when we looked at children with autism, these are the ones here on the left on each one of these bars, you can see that the enzymes are dramatically reduced. The lactase, the maltase, the sucrase, and the transporters are too, but the housekeeping genes are not. So they can't break down or absorb the sugars. And the effects of that are that all the sugar then flows downstream into the gastrointestinal tract and actually changes the microbiota. And we actually found a specific bacterium called Sutterella, which is present only in the kids with autism. Now, this may or may not give us some explanation for why some kids respond to antibiotics, some kids respond to probiotics, some kids respond to dietary restriction, and at least now we have various candidates that we can test rigorously and scientifically in double-blinded trials to determine, in fact, whether or not there's any relationship between the microflora, the GI complaints, and the relationship between the GI complaints and the neurological manifestations. So it's not proof, but it's interesting. And this is now, that's just been accepted for publication. Now, the last sort of models I want to talk with you about are those where prenatal infection has a long-standing effect that may not be appreciated for a long time. I first became involved in looking at viruses as causes of disease in San Francisco in 81 to 84. I was there when HIV emerged, and I was blown away by the fact that it took us so long to figure out what was going on. And in those days, it was called GRID, gay-related immunodeficiency disease, and people were talking about sperm allergies and amyl nitrate intoxication and Epstein-Barr virus, and it took a long time to figure out what the virus was. And as a result, many people became infected, and the outbreak really took off and became pandemic. There was no way to protect the blood supply and so forth. So I became invested at that point, spent the next years, 6 years, trying to find ways in which we could change this whole field of microbe hunting. The second seminal event for me was in 1985, when there was a report that came out in a prominent journal called Science Magazine that talked about a virus that caused depression. And I used methods which were then quite primitive for subtractive cloning to identify a virus known as Borne disease virus, which was the first identified using only molecular methods. But it became clear to me that you couldn't implicate a single agent. It's much more likely that there was some common pathway that was triggered by any virus, and potentially other microbes like toxo and Treponema pallidum, animal models and so forth revealed some linkages there too. Now, if you take garden variety influenza virus and put it into a mouse halfway through gestation, so this is a, you know, mouse typically takes 18 to 20 days from conception to birth, and you expose the animal either to influenza virus or to something called lipopolysaccharide, which is a component of bacterial cell walls, or to double-stranded RNA in the form of something called poly-IC, which looks like a replicating virus, even though there's no virus present, you get the same kinds of effect. So this is a control animal exploring a cage. It's just over about 30 minutes. It runs around the cage, and then it settles down. Here's an animal that's seen virus or LPS or poly-IC. It doesn't make any difference. It's withdrawn. It doesn't walk around the cage at all. Here's a control animal at gestational day 16. So this is now two-thirds of the way through gestation. Here's an animal that sees virus or LPS or poly-IC, and this animal's running around the cage. So the same genetic background of mouse, the same stimulus, virus, bacterium, what have you, halfway through gestation, withdrawn, not moving around very much, this animal's hyperactive. So clearly, the timing of exposure can be critical. Now, this is the way that, who's working in neurobiology here this year? Anybody in neurobiology? One person, okay. Are you doing any work with progenitor cells or? Okay, all right. So, but you know something about the development of the nervous system. So you know that neurons start more or less in the center and move out centrifugally, right, over the course of development. And there are a number of different cells that are progenitors. So you've got these radioglia, which are precursors of the intermediate progenitors, and then you've got those which can give rise to neurons. And so you start here, and they slowly move out until you have these nice, this nice lamellar architecture here, right? So Jawari Di Miranda decided to look at the molecular and cellular substrate of this phenomenon that we'd seen in mice. And what we found was that if you expose animals to poly-IC at roughly gestational day 16, the following occurs. This is a FACS plot. So what this allows you to do is to quantitate the number of cells in a certain population. And it's not important to do anything other than just look at the fact that this red curve is normal and the blue curve is not. And this is a log chart, so you're going from a peak of, say, 10 to the fourth down to 10 to the three. So that means you've lost 90% of your progenitor cells in the whole cortex. The same thing occurs in the outer layers of the cortex. So without any infection at all, but with something that mimics infection, as a result of exposure to something that looks like a virus or looks like a bacterium, you lose 90% of your stem cells. Now, if you take out the receptor using genetically modified mice so that that receptor is not recognized by the ligand, there's no difference between the animal that sees the virus and the animal that sees the control. So remember, when you go back here, there's a huge difference. This is the normal, this is the abnormal. Use a genetically modified mouse that can't respond to the viral mimic, there's no difference. You can superimpose the two. And if you use a drug which has the same effect, which knocks out that response to this ligand, there's no difference between the animal, again, that sees the virus and the animal that sees the control. So what this tells us is that there's a period of vulnerability during the development of the nervous system where if someone is pregnant, whether they're a mouse or a human being, there's a huge risk of loss of stem cells, which may manifest as Parkinson's disease with an earlier onset, Alzheimer's, behavioral disturbances in childhood, what have you. All this remains to be worked out. But the principle has been established, and now we go back, do the epidemiology using the methods that we've developed, that we've talked about, to try to figure out who has seen what. So in the last portion of my talk, I'm going to describe where the future of this field is going, and this is a wonderful quote from Niels Bohr, which I like. Have you seen this one, Sam? Prediction is very difficult, especially about the future. And I think it probably says it all. So, well, that's if you come to a fork in the road, take it. But it's very the same general idea. So, so there are a lot of web-based surveillance platforms. I haven't talked about them, but increasingly now we're going over the net and looking for people who are searching various databases and asking questions about what this means, what that means, as a clue to whether or not there might be an infection or an intoxication or radiation exposure in a specific geographic area. Sequencing is getting cheaper, surveillance platforms are moving out, serology is getting better, and so forth. Now, when the Emerging Infectious Diseases Regional Centers of Excellence program was established in 2002, 2003, it was in response to 9/11 and the anthrax attacks, both of which hit us locally, and it became very clear that the greatest challenge was not so much man-made risk, but nature's risks. But this is now resurfacing because synthetic biology has made it very inexpensive now to do whatever you want. So the discussions, for example, which are being held now about eradicating the smallpox stocks are moot because I can make smallpox. I mean, I wouldn't, but I could. It wouldn't be difficult. It would take me about 3 weeks. So, you know, and maybe I couldn't do it in a cave in Afghanistan in 3 weeks. Maybe it would take me a year, but you can make these things. And all these new synthetic machines, when they're, you know, when they become obsolete, they still work and they wind up on eBay and they go all over the world. So it's a problem. Now, the work that I originally did with isolating cDNA clones of Borne disease virus took me 3 years. Over the matter of the past few years, we've done literally hundreds of different agents from all sorts of animals and so forth. Microarrays are going to be actionable and are going to be coming to emergency rooms. This is some early work we did with a first generation array that allowed us to recognize in a panmicrobial format the presence of malaria when people thought it was Marburg virus in the middle of a Marburg virus outbreak. Now these things are becoming automated. They're fast. They're cheap. They're going to be about $50 a run. So you're going to be seeing them used, and you're going to look at sequences like this and so forth. Now, one of the things we're trying to do to get a handle on diseases before they move from animals into humans is to pursue what we call hotspot modeling. Hotspot modeling examines issues like poverty, migration, deforestation, climate change and its effects on the distribution of blood, you know, blood-sucking insects like ticks, mosquitoes, undiagnosed events, and population density. So the red areas are the ones that are the hottest. So here you can see there's a lot of accumulation of meats, you know, from, you know, in Congo and Angola and so forth, from bushmeat. And we talked a little bit about bushmeat earlier. There's a lot of bushmeat over here. Here it's simply population density and changes in land use. And you can map all these things in terms of what's important or not. And then you decide to go in there and survey people who are likely to come into contact with different agents. Now, this is a paper that's in press coming out shortly, which shows the distribution of a bat that carries a new Ebola virus. Now, we don't typically think about Ebola virus as being present anywhere except in Africa. But it's actually has the potential to be all over the world. So this particular bat species, Meniopterus schreibseri, has a distribution in South Africa, Western Africa, the Mediterranean, Asia, portions of Australia, and so forth. And we found in a cave called the Lovu Cave, Cavo di Lovo in the Iberian Peninsula, that there were bats dying. And when we sampled them, we found that they were infected with a novel virus. So these are trees which illustrate the relationships of viruses to one another. So these are paramyxa viruses, which include parainfluenza viruses and Sendai virus and so forth, the pneumoviruses, and here's the Ebola viruses and the Marburg viruses, and this thing looks different. And in fact, as a result of discovering this virus, we now know that filoviruses go back probably as far back as 40 million years. And there's all sorts of interesting evolutionary work that you can do. Here's a GBV-like virus. This is very similar to hepatitis C that we discovered in 2010 in bats in Bangladesh. John Epstein here is holding this bat. He's with EcoHealth Alliance as well as with Columbia. And at that point, it was the closest relative to hepatitis C. The hepatitis C infects 200 million people worldwide and is the second most common cause of liver failure and cancer. More recently, looking at dogs in the United States coming from shelters in Texas, Utah, and Pennsylvania, where there were acute outbreaks of respiratory disease, we found a virus that's even closer, which led us to believe now that the origin of hepatitis C is probably not primates, which is where everyone was looking. They were looking at chimpanzees and so forth, thinking it would be a similar situation to what was described with HIV. Now, dogs have been with humans for a long time. This is a fragment from a little over 10,000 years ago. It was in feces, so at that point, we're eating dogs, right? In an evolutionary sense, dogs separated from us about 60 million years ago, but again, they've been with us for this period of time. Now, this particular virus, which is shown here, canine hepatitis, is now the closest relative of hepatitis C. So now there are animal models that can be done using dogs instead of chimpanzees. I have mixed feelings about that, but you know, I guess that's better than chimpanzees. And we now have some insights into tropism, how this virus goes into liver, causes disease, and so forth. So this has literally turned the whole field of hepatitis C on its head, because it's now given people different ways to look at the problem. Now, one of the things that I wanted to do in beginning to do pathogen, pursue pathogen discovery, was to find a way to look at cancers, autoimmune disease, diabetes mellitus, encephalitis, syndromes or diseases where for a long time people have thought infection might play a role, either as the primary cause or as a cofactor. And the challenge has been that when you use an unbiased method for amplification, you amplify everything by definition. So you don't see the signal. And I showed you the example when we did this experiment with the women who received the organs from the man who had lymphocytic meningitis virus. 14 out of 100,000 sequences were relevant. Well, if it's present at lower concentrations, because it's a chronic disease, you may not see it at all. So what we've done is to find refined ways now in which sample preparation can enhance our efficiency. So this is just an estimate of coverage of regions of the genome of the Lujo virus, than the one that we talked about that caused that acute disease in South Africa and in Zambia that killed the 8 to 5 people. And you can see that using traditional methods, we didn't get a lot of sequence. Using this new method, which subtracts ribosomal RNA and DNA and so forth, we can get 3 orders of magnitude more sequence that's relevant to answering the question. We're also developing serological arrays so we can look at the history of infection. And lastly, we're working with large unselected cohorts. The idea here being we collect materials prenatally, immediately postnatally, so as that people move through life and as various diseases become manifest, we can go back and examine samples that were collected with an unbiased eye in a prospective fashion and ask whether there are biomarkers or agents or exposures that might be associated with an increased risk of disease. Mobile laboratories are moving out into the developing world. This is a very poor prototype. We're making much smaller ones. For example, we did some work recently in Haiti where people thought that polio had reemerged, and in fact, it wasn't polio at all. What had happened had been that individuals were presenting with diarrhea and hyponatremia, very, very low levels of sodium in their serum, and they were rapidly rehydrated, and they developed a syndrome called locked-in syndrome, which essentially was demyelination in the pons of the brainstem. So one of the things that these trucks is going to try to do is to provide basic support so that people can get chemistries, hematologies, gram stains, and so forth. Now, on the 9th of September, this movie is going into theater-wide release. The premiere in Venice for the critics is on the 3rd of September, and there is a premiere in New York on the 7th that you'll be, and you'll be seeing this thing everywhere. It's going to be, it's already everywhere, right? So, and there's a benefit for our institute on the 8th, which will be attended by many of these people. So this is by far the best movie that's ever been made about an outbreak, because the director and the screenwriter took pains to make certain that it would be as accurate as it could be and still sell tickets. They still ultimately have to sell tickets. And I spent 4 weeks on set writing and rewriting. All the entire soundtrack was recorded, with the exception of the music, at Columbia, believe it or not, all the lab scenes. And the virus was designed at Columbia. And Jennifer Ely and Kate Winslet and Elliot Gould all trained here and learned how to pipette and pull things out of liquid nitrogen and so forth. So, you know, you had an illustrious group preceding you in training in that lab. Thanks very much.